Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as the media obsesses on Donald Trump's tweets, he rolls along quietly in the background, changing our country with strokes of his pen. In the last two business days, it was the end of two major Obama-era policies, the Clean Power Plan to limit carbon emissions, and the promise under Obamacare that every health insurance policy would include contraception coverage, both being abolished by the president and his true believer appointees. Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, ending the contraception coverage guarantee as an expansion of what he calls religious liberty, and Trump's EPA Director, Scott Pruitt, who has ties to the oil and coal industries.
Tomorrow in Washington, D.C., I'll be signing a proposed rule to withdraw the so-called Clean Power Plan of the past administration and thus begin the effort to withdraw that rule.
Also yesterday, the president announced what he wants from Democrats in exchange for preserving DACA, the program to allow young adults brought here illegally as children by their parents to stay in the U.S. legally. His demands include a major overhaul and shrinking of our legal immigration system, something Democrats are unlikely to agree to. But add to all this a new Trump critic within the Republican Party, who analysts are saying could start a broader defection. Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, who, as you probably heard by now, has announced he will not seek re-election next year, and then told the New York Times this weekend that the Trump tweets and foreign policies could lead us to World War III, and that Trump's behavior in the White House forces his aides to treat their jobs like adult daycare. He used that phrase, adult daycare. For example, here's 20 seconds of Corker speaking to the Times, referring to Defense Secretary James Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
One of the reasons I supported Mattis and Tillerson and Kelly last week is, again, as long as there's people like that around him, they're able to talk him down and, you know, when it gets spun up, you know, calm him down and continue to work with him before a decision is made.
Talk him down and calm him down and continue to work with him before a decision is made. Senator Bob Corker, my first guest today, builds on that notion. Josh Dawsey, Politico White House correspondent, has an article today titled White House Aides Lean on Delays and Distraction to Manage Trump. Hi, Josh. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So where do you start with this? You start with Ryan Priebus in your article, and Priebus saying when he was White House Chief of Staff, he learned not to say no to Trump, but instead to say later.
Right. So Corker stated something that White House aides and advisors and people close to the president essentially say is true. There is a lot of managing that goes on with the president. He, you know, will watch a segment on television and decide to make a pretty drastic decision, like, let's say, pulling out of NAFTA or, you know, changing immigration policy. And then they will go through a series of meetings and movements and phone calls to try to stop that from happening. Ryan Priebus was a kind of a delay. His tactic was to, you know, we'll do it next week. Let's talk about it later. Hope the president will move on. John Kelly has tried a tactic of trying to limit information that gets to his desk, like Breitbart and InfoWars and other information that may not be credible, and to limit the people who call him and who has access to the Oval Office. Some of his allies go into the media and try to say things on television, hoping they can speak to him directly. There's a number of tactics that go into managing the president, and I think Corker has been present for many of those calls. He's been someone that White House officials have relied on to talk to the president about Iran, North Korea, other foreign quagmires. They've had Corker come into the Oval Office or to call the president and walking back from a brink of an idea that may have had deleterious effects.
You used Trump impulsively wanting to pull out of NAFTA as an example, or raise tariffs on China. You spoke to 10 current or former Trump officials who talked about containing him with various strategies. It's really interesting to me that Corker himself, as a Republican leader, as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, was brought in to try to talk Trump down, as Corker put it in that clip, on various things. And now he comes out and says how dangerous Trump is and he might start World War III. Corker must have experience firsthand over how hard it is to be effective as one of Trump's handlers.
I think that's correct, Brian. I also think there's a rising frustration among Republicans. Corker expressed that publicly. Most others have not been willing to go on the record yet of the president's whims and his, you know, propensity for conflict and his willingness to get into feuds with all sorts of people. If it's Joe and Mika on Morning Joe, it's one thing. If it's North Korea, Kim Jong-un calling him a little rocket man and seeming to promise war via Twitter and, you know, undercutting his own Secretary of State, Those are things that have broader implications. And I think for folks like Corker, there was a sense early on in the presidency, hey, he tapped into something. He's the president. You know, we have to deal with this guy. And there's going to be a learning curve, and we want to be helpful. You know, he's the president. And I think now they're sensing, hey, we're 8-9 months in. He hasn't changed. If anything, his rhetoric has grown. More bellicose has grown into more of a fighter. And, you know, I think we're getting a little sick and tired of it, is what you're hearing from Corker and others, because there doesn't seem to be a desire to have any of the reining in of the impulses that some people hoped would come eventually.
So, listeners, if you want to call in and join the conversation or ask a question about Bob Corker being the latest Republican to say the emperor has no clothes, or the policy items from the last couple of days that we will get to pertaining to DACA, pertaining to the Clean Power Plant plan, pertaining to contraception coverage and health insurance plans, 212-433-WNYC for Josh Dawsey, political White House correspondent, 212-433-9692. To stay on Corker for a minute, he has come out as this emperor has no clothes Republican just after announcing that he will not run for re-election as senator from Tennessee next year. Trump tweeted that Corker has no guts for not doing so and then denouncing Trump. But, you know, Trump's schoolyard taunts aside, why is Corker doing it this way? Why doesn't he run in a primary as a Trump is dangerous conservative Republican and win or lose, make that moral stand and fight that fight?
Well, I think Corker said for a while he may be done after two terms. You know, he's in his 60s. I think his aides have told me and others that, you know, maybe he's not just having as much fun anymore. A lot of the Republicans, Brian, have not had a lot of fun in the Trump presidency. And I'm not saying that to say we should pity them or anything. But, you know, there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes fighting and concerns and recriminations. And I think why you're seeing Corker say this now is he doesn't have anything to lose. In 2018, you know, he's out. He's gone. The next 15 minutes, the next 15 months, not minutes, he can be a little bit more, you know, free thought and saying what he believes instead of, you know, hewing to the party line. I mean, one of the reasons I think he hasn't done it before now is that President Trump is very popular in Tennessee. You know, Corker has told me, he's told my colleagues that when he goes back home to Tennessee, he is amazed at how popular the president remains. And when he criticizes the president, he gets all sorts of flack back home. So I would argue that one of the reasons he has not made these criticisms so potent before is out of political expediency. And concerned about, you know, what they would mean for him. And now he doesn't have those shackles anymore, and he can say more of what he actually thinks.
And what part of what Corker actually thinks, what he said in that Times interview, is that a lot of his colleagues think the same thing that he does. And so if you take the two pieces of that together, one is managing Trump is like adult daycare in the White House, but the other is, you know, much more serious than just casting aspersions on Trump's maturity. It's that Corker, as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is afraid that Trump is going to start World War III. If other Republicans in the Senate do believe that, as Corker suggests, then don't they have a responsibility to do something more drastic? Michelle Goldberg's article and column in the Times today says, okay, if you think he's such a danger to national security and world peace, act on it, meaning take steps to remove him. So don't other Republicans need to at least come out, if Corker is right that they agree with him, and say, we are really worried about what's going to happen. That's really, really serious.
You could certainly make that argument, and the argument that words are a bit vacuous and actions mean a lot more. For a lot of these members, I think they're a little uncertain what to do. I do think there are concerns across Republicans in the Senate, at least from my reporting and my colleagues' reporting, about Trump. I don't know how many of them believe exactly that he's going to send us into World War III, as Corker said. But there are, you know, a number of concerns about the president. I think what they've been bothered by in the Senate and in the House, and even a lot of his aides, have been this, you know, brinksmanship with North Korea, this taunting of a dictator who was trying to develop nuclear weapons. The president has said repeatedly, you know, we've talked to him for decades, nothing's ever changed, they've continued to create these missiles that endanger us, now we have to do something different. But it doesn't seem to be an exact strategy. There just seems to be, you know, tweets, undercutting, as we said earlier, Secretary of State, a lot of bravado, a little rocket man. No one is really elaborating on what he wants to do. And he says only one thing will work. Well, what is that thing? So I think when Corker and these others watch him do this, watch him think about decertifying the nuclear, the Iran deal, which a lot of folks are saying Iran has followed the terms of the deal. They are believed to have followed the terms, where the president wants to decertify it anyway. These are destabilizing steps, and when you're making these in rapid succession, you know, there are domino effects. In the United States, I think in Washington, a lot of people are to the point where they kind of don't really take the president's words seriously anymore. They're accustomed to his morning tweets, they're accustomed to, you know, his tics and his fights and his feuds and his anger and his mood shifts. But across the world, people, you know, don't necessarily have that same opinion. And they say, oh, that's the president of the United States speaking. So you get into some delicate situations, I think, to say the least.
Leslie in the West Village, you're on WNYC with Josh Dawsey from Politico. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I would just like to say that it seems to me that your first segment and this segment dovetail nicely in terms of a moral, which is, there's a whispering network that's going on, and all it takes is for a brave person, a few brave people, to speak out to begin to dismantle something that doesn't work and is causing real harm to people.
Nice thread. That's a really great way to put together a show. I wish I had thought of it like that. But thank you very much. Yeah. Like with a few people finally speaking out about Harvey Weinstein, and something that was an open secret in his circles is now public, a few people like Bob Corker speaking out, and now what's an open secret? Well, of course, everybody already saw this about Donald Trump, but in a way, Josh, what the open secret is that other Republicans think it too, but are afraid to say it.
Sure. I'm not convinced, though, that this will be what breaks a dam on criticism of him. I think some in the White House are concerned that other Republicans who have privately groused to them about the president's tendencies and how he manages the country, I will say that publicly. But a lot of these senators, a lot of these congressmen, govern a lot based on what their polls say and what they think is in their best interest. And if the president continues to kind of stay around 40%, if he's still popular in Republican districts, I don't know that we see a groundswell of people like Corker. I know that there's an argument to be made. People should stand up. They should do what's right for moral authority if they believe that. But I just don't see it happening yet, Brian. I think it takes a few more people or a few more bigger incidents to bring, one lone senator who's retiring on the Republican ranks into more of a, you know, cacophony of senators who are saying the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But one specific thing that analysts are saying could come of Corker coming out is that it could affect Trump's tax reform plans with Congress, which, of course, sure, are the next big legislative thing. Why is this relevant to that? Isn't the history of Republican denunciations of Trump's fitness for office that they are then followed by going ahead anyway on policy when they agree? John McCain has done that. Lindsey Graham has done that. So why is this even relevant to the fate of the tax plan?
Well, Corker said publicly that he does not want to support a tax plan that would ramp up the deficit further. What the president is proposing right now would ramp up the deficit further, maybe by more than $1 trillion. this, you know, sharp cut in corporate income taxes from 35% to 20%, a change in a lot of deductions, state and local tax exemptions gone. You know, this would create more of a deficit. The president's supporters obviously argue that it would also boost the economy and it would be worth it to create this deficit. But the president has a very slim majority in Congress. You know, 52 Republicans. He needs at least 50 of them to vote on any given issue. And then you have a number of Rand Paul, who has been very skeptical to vote, you know, for almost anything. Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, Susan Collins in Maine, Bob Corker, you know, a number of other moderate Republicans who have not always gone along with the president and have already begun expressing concerns about tax reform. So, and then you have in tax reform, obviously, just a whole host of lobbyists and special interests who are going to, you know, make this very difficult for them to do. And I don't think anyone in the White House is of the illusion that this is going to be easy. So when you start alienating senators and you give them reason to voice opposition to you, and you already have a razor-thin majority where you really can't lose more than two people on any given issue, it creates some headaches.
So let's get to some of the things the president can do and is doing without Congress. Tell me about the Clean Power Plan undoing. What will be the impact of that on energy jobs, which is, I think, one of the things Trump is after here, or energy prices, or on carbon emissions, which is what Obama's Clean Power Plan was all about?
Right. Yeah, it was the 2015, you know, Obama administration rule on this, and it was to, you know, limit the carbon emissions by more than 30% over until 2030, and to make the states, you know, enforce it and to make the states comply with it. And a number of the states sued, a lot of the industry groups sued, and yesterday we saw, you know, Scott Pruitt come out and say they were going to reverse that executive action and no longer would have to follow the Clean Power Plant rule. And it's one of the trademarks of a Trump administration that we've seen time and time again, Brian. Anything that President Obama did by executive action, we've seen President Trump and his cabinet basically try to undo it immediately. This is one of the bigger policy implications, I would say, so far that they've undone by executive action. But we've seen a whole host of others, as you alluded to earlier in the show.
And that was already in court, challenging Obama's executive authority to do that without Congress. And the contraception coverage and health...
Can I make one more point on the EPA, Brian?
Please do.
So one of the big things we've seen with Scott Pruitt is his extensive ties, as you mentioned, to you know, oil and gas executives. He just installed a coal lobbyist as his number two at the EPA. He's tried to go to places like West Virginia and Kentucky time and time again, you know, to talk about coal and bringing back coal jobs. A lot of analysts and experts and people who study this say that the decline in coal jobs cannot be reversed immediately by any sort of, you know, Trump administration doctrine, and, you know, it's not possible. But you've seen the president time and time again say, you know, we're going to support coal. We're going to support coal. We're going to bring coal mines back. Not sure that it's sound environmental policy, but it is certainly driving the administration and is, you know, making all of these rhetorical promises on bringing coal jobs back. I don't think that will happen with or without the Clean Power Plant being around.
And they sell it as good economic policy, but it's not necessarily good economic policy either. It's, you know, kind of Trump's bent toward nostalgia, running, you know, butting heads with science and emerging technologies. For example, there was an article just the other day, I think in the New York Times, about how China is going to wind up bending the curve of the world toward using electric cars because they're generating this technology, and it's going to be affordable, and it's going to be cheaper than gasoline cars, and it's going to be more convenient than having to stop and fill up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, people have to charge their electric cars, but rather than Trump saying, we are going to own the future and be the country that develops the electric car industry, he's ignoring that and saying, we're going to bring back clean, beautiful coal.
Clean, beautiful coal.
He did say that. I wish I pulled that clip.
That,
he did
yes.
say clean, beautiful coal.
And he talked about how they would even clean the coal, which I do not think is possible. But there does seem to be a bit of nostalgia there. You know, one reason the president won in so many states is he went to these, you know, small towns that have been, you know, basically have deteriorated over decades. in places like, you know, West Virginia and Iowa and South Carolina, where kind of the jobs have left. And, you know, I drove through some of these towns on the campaign trail, and they are sad places. And he's talked to those people about bringing back a way of life that, you know, was decades early or 50 years earlier, make America great again, you know, is the quintessential slogan. And, you know, that seems promising to many of these people. A lot of this is impossible to do. And as you said, you know, the economy is heading in one direction and much of the rest of the world is heading in one direction. And it's really unclear whether any of the president's promises on coal and bringing back factory jobs and a lot of the things he said to these more, you know, decrepit mill towns that have been hurt over, you know, 50, 100 years of globalization, whether he can make any of that happen. But it certainly is an appealing political slogan.
Yeah. And the contraception coverage and health insurance plans, Trump is choosing the religious liberty of any employer who provides health insurance to declare themselves conscientious objectors to birth control coverage, that takes precedence over the public health rights of women to be covered, or even the religious liberty of women to make that decision for themselves rather than having their employers make it for them. I mean, abortion is one thing. Why is Trump going all the way to contraception? Is he that religiously conservative?
I don't think he's religiously conservative at all, Brian. I think we all know he is a thrice married, you know, New York real estate mogul who was known for philandering and his exploits on in the tabloids. I don't think we imagine as Trump as a parishioner who sits on the first pew every Sunday. I do think Trump has made a political calculation with evangelicals. He often has preachers at the White House. He has a lot of social conservatives at the White House. You know, he's really listening to these people. He sees them as core to his movement, his political movement. I don't think he necessarily shares deep down some of the same views that they share. In fact, I've talked to some of these religious leaders for stories, and they're not even sure that he shares their same views, but he has been willing to implement policy time and time again that they like. You know, if you talk to social conservatives, religious conservatives, you know, they have a lot of skepticism towards some of Trump's bluster and some of the things he said, the Access Hollywood tape, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, he's executed a lot of policies in the White House that have made social and religious conservatives very happy, and they're willing to overlook some of the personal peccadilloes for, you know, the greater good of this mandate, so to speak. But there have been many other occasions as well where he has, you know, chosen what religious conservatives want him to do. I talked to Ralph Reed recently, who, you know, runs a Faith and Family Coalition, big group of, you know, church-based organizations, and he says, you know, they're happier with any president since Reagan on President Trump, and I thought that was a pretty startling comment, but I do understand it from a policy perspective.
And the DACA deal proposal, before you go, and people remember there was that headline a few weeks ago about how Trump said he's working on a deal with Chuck and Nancy, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, to protect the Dreamers, the young adults who were brought here illegally as children by their parents, who Obama, with an executive action, allowed to stay, and it was going to be challenged in court. And Trump, who seems in his heart to be kind of pro-DACA, undid it as an executive action, but said he's going to look for a deal with Congress and that the contours of a deal were there to be had, not with the Republicans, who would never go along with it, but with the Democrats in Congress. Now he's come out with all these pretty hard-line immigration details that the Democrats would have to give in exchange, like shrinking the legal immigration system significantly. Right. So, Josh, from what you can tell, is this the start of a bipartisan negotiation, or is this a way of blowing up the prospect of one?
I think it's a bit of a poison pill for a bipartisan negotiation. You know, money for the wall, cutting off grants to sanctuary cities like New York, you know, extra ICE agents and lawyers, cutting legal immigration. Some of these proposals, Brian, are even contentious among Republicans. And I think you're going to see folks on the Hill over the next few months try to come to a bipartisan agreement. It's unclear what the president and his team will accept. As you said earlier, you know, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, left the White House thinking there was the outlines of a tentative deal. no wall money than some of the president's more hardline aides. Stephen Miller, who's kind of his immigration expert, put together this extensive package working with the Freedom Caucus and some others on the right, and the president signed off on it. So it kind of reversed the progress that seemed to be made between Schumer and Pelosi and Trump. And I think to some degree, Brian, we're back at square one. You know, there seemed to be a quick deal there. Trump was looking for an immediate win to show that he could work with Schumer and Pelosi. And then once the policy and the harder parts came to pass, he kind of has, you know, gone back on that deal. And now we're at a place where, you know, the Democrats, even some Republicans, are going to see this as a total non-starter, this package of kind of hardline things the White House is pushing. So we're going to start basically from scratch, seeing if they can do anything in the next 6 months before this expires. And, you know, there's all sorts of ramifications with, you know, immigration, et cetera.
Josh Dawsey, White House correspondent for Politico. You got any scoops before you go? You know, the last time you were on, we talked about all the stuff that was in the news. And then the next day, you dropped this bombshell that you reported about Michael Flynn doing business with this company that was trying to create a nuclear power revolution in the Middle East, which in itself is hilarious because right. Of all the countries that probably don't need nuclear power plants, it's the ones that are saturated with oil. But that he hadn't disclosed that when he was becoming national security advisor, those financial relationships with foreign countries. So you got any scoops for us before you go?
Brian, I love you. I think your radio show is the best in New York, but I do not think my employer wants me to tell my scoops on your air. So I think I will have to pass on that.
That is a fair answer. We will keep watching Politico for those scoops when they get scooped. Bye, Josh Dawsey, White House correspondent. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.